Okay, everyone, here we go. We're going on to Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 140C, and we've been looking at some of the emerging effects on the fixed cross, the vast experience of group life and group activity, the realization in consciousness of a vision of the endless way of which nirvana is but the beginning, that sense of endless and ongoing progress, and the task of mediatorship as hierarchy mediates between Shambhala and humanity, so the individual knows that he must also mediate. He carries on the task of invocation and evocation. He seeks to invoke and thus evoke the world thinkers and aspirants. And he is also involved to some measure in invoking the will to save of the Shambhala lords. This, in a way, I suppose, is more the function of hierarchy, but some disciples are involved in this as well in their cooperation with hierarchy. So it goes on to say here that there awakens in him, therefore, a vague determination at first, which gives place in time to the evocation of the will in himself. A vague determination, which gives place eventually to the evocation of the will in himself. This happens on the fixed cross, and we certainly have signs of determination there. There's much strength in these signs. Just think of them. Taurus and determination, Leo and self-confidence, Scorpio and the accumulation of power, and Aquarius somehow synthesizing all of these under Uranus. This eventually puts him in rapport, on rapport with the will aspect of deity as it emanates and is stepped down from Shambhala via hierarchy, into which spiritual organization he is gradually being integrated through the experience of the fixed cross. That's important. Gradual integration into hierarchy on the fixed cross. So he is being put en rapport with the will aspect of deity. Okay. The fixed cross, although it does not endure for a long time in the relatively in the history of the evolution of the human being, is extremely important in helping him make the transition into the next kingdom, and takes him onward towards the possibility of transition into the kingdom of planetary lives at Chohanship. But the fixed cross does not extend that far. By the time one is a master and moving beyond that, it is the monadic ray which is really all important. So it might be pointed out here that, or here be pointed out that, experience upon the mutable cross integrates a man into the center we call humanity. Maybe some of the very early examples of those upon the mutable cross are not really integrated. They're even closer to the animal kingdom, although they are human. And maybe this took place really in earlier times when there were those who were simply bud lotuses and they did not have one petal open. Now we're told that everyone, every human being on this planet has at least one petal open. Experience upon the fixed cross integrates the disciple into the second planetary center, which we call the hierarchy. And so that large circle that we may remember, this is the circle that shows us that we are, in fact, within the boundary of the hierarchy. In a way, of course, the entire planetary hierarchy here could even be a red circle. It does include Sanat Kumara. But the way it's laid out, we use hierarchy in a larger sense, and not in a specific sense. Experience on the cardinal cross integrates the initiate into the primary planetary center, to which we give the name Shambhala. So we have three types of experience, three types of integration. a synthesis is created with these energies, which makes a person or an individual firmly a part of the three planetary centers sequentially. If we do not feel ourselves yet integrated into the hierarchy, then surely we are on the fixed cross. We are by no means ready to be integrated into Shambhala. So he eventually becomes a radiating center of spiritual will, affecting humanity and evoking its will to good. That is one of his tasks as a mediator, facing humanity, invoking humanity, and thus evoking its will to good. He blends this into the hierarchy as far as he can, fusing the human will into hierarchical activity in an effort to evoke response from Shambhala. So he is looking below, to look above, to help below. He's looking below and evoking the will to good in humanity, and as much as he can, within himself also, he seeks to fuse the human will, or the developing will to good in his own nature, in order to evoke response from Shambhala. But a sufficient number of human beings are animated by the will to good. If sufficient number of human beings are animated by the will to good, then there is a greater chance that Shambhala may be evoked in a way which will affect humanity positively. Sometimes there have been interventions by Shambhala in the ancient Lemurian days and Atlantean days, and probably these interventions were not the result of invocation from humanity, but they were decisions made by the supervisory planetary logos. Maybe they were evoked in some way by the hierarchy of the time. But now humanity plays a much bigger role in determining its own destiny. Shambhala is the place of destiny. The monad is that which has destiny. The monad is part of Shambhala. So we are now becoming responsible for our fate, for our destiny, as we invoke the plan, the purpose, the higher will. These things, the words plan, purpose, will, they now mean something to the higher type of human being. And we are involved in calling them, quote, down. So the second of the invocations there, really, let light and love and power and death fulfill the purpose of the coming one. I mean, we are calling down these great energies, and we are doing so with deliberation, and we are participating in their view of the world, and we are decentralized and no longer looking for the strictly personal solution. It would be so interesting to know just what effect that invocation had on the response of the Lords of Liberation. DK is very mysterious about their response. He doesn't say how the withdrawal of the hierarchy was avoided. If you think about it, that hierarchy that we trust so much, and which has been so instrumental in bringing the wisdom to humanity, it almost withdrew from the human sphere of influence because they believed that humanity would go down. Those are the words the Tibetan uses, and they are shocking words. I'm always shocked when I go down. Believe. Yes, here it is. I always refresh my mind with this sobering reminder. The plans for closer contact with the evolutionary process in the three worlds and the effort to blend and fuse the two divine centers, the hierarchy and humanity, into one working, collaborating whole seemed doomed to destruction. Their fusion would have meant the appearance of the kingdom of God on earth, which was well anticipated in the first books before the Second World War broke out. The obstacles to this fusion, owing to the active tension of the dark forces, seemed at that time insuperable. We believed that man would go down to defeat. We the hierarchy. Owing to his selfishness and his misuse of the principle of free will, we made all preparation to withdraw, and yet at the same time we struggled to get humanity to choose rightly and to see the issues clearly. It's such a drama. You know, one day maybe, can it be well dramatized, but one day maybe in a movie, in a film, could be directed by Steven Spielberg if he thought that such things were realities or sufficiently evocative. The necessity to withdraw was averted. I may not say in what manner, beyond telling you that the Lords of Liberation took certain unexpected steps. This they were led to do owing to the invocative powers of humanity, used consciously by all those upon the side of the will to good and unconsciously by men and women of goodwill, all men of goodwill. So basically, it was a dual invocation of the kind the Tibetan discussed. The invocation correlated with the first of the great invocation stanzas, and that correlated with the second. Owing to these steps, the efforts of those fighting in the realm of science for the establishing of true knowledge and right human relations were aided. The trend of the power to know and to discover a definite form of energy was deflected away from the demanding evocative minds of those seeking to destroy the world of men, leading to a form of mental paralysis. Those seeking to emphasize the right values and to save humanity were simultaneously stimulated to the point of success. This connection of the first and the fifth ray. The fifth ray ashram was involved. The atomic power also is closely related to the first ray ashram. The Lords of Liberation are first ray beings. A deflection was in some way engineered. The allies and all related people would have gone down had the forces of materialism discovered and implemented the secrets of atomic energy first. And that was an imminent possibility. So this is, you know, maybe the most dramatic event of which we are aware in this whole teaching, basically the saving of humanity by the Lords of Liberation through this deflecting power. After so much work, so much hope, after founding the Theosophical Society, releasing the ageless wisdom into the consciousness of humanity, to have to come to that point in the 1940s when the hierarchy actually believed humanity would go down to destruction. I mean, I can't think of more sobering thoughts. What do they think now? When they look at countries with maybe affected deeply by ideology having atomic weapons, what do they think now? Well, time will tell. The cross of the risen Christ, this is the cardinal cross. More upon this subject I may not give you, nor will it profit for me to enlarge upon the conditions which emerge in the consciousness of the initiate on the cardinal cross. So little is said of the will, so little is said of the first aspect of divinity and of the structures which express and mediate that energy. So little is said of the monad compared to that which is said of the soul. My words would be meaningless. Most of you are in the transition state wherein you are stabilizing your individual will and are attempting increasingly to express it in the will to good. I mean, this is still a a transition in a way from the mutable cross to the fixed cross. Most of those for whom he is writing are in the initial stages of the fixed cross, and some more well-established, and some, maybe some, preparing to leave the fixed cross. He does give hints, after all, for those who are initiates of the fourth degree, even. And we're told that the book, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the third and fourth book, are read by those who are masters. So there is some instruction here, quite deeply veiled, I suspect, that is given for high initiates, but most are not yet firm in their will to good. I would have you deeply realize that if the will to peace is conditioning you, he's trying to bring, I think, certain pacifists around. As among the readers of these books could have been found those who simply wished for the peace to return and the great attack to go away. If the will to peace is conditioning you, then you are still working on emotional levels, and your work will then be with the first stanza of the great invocation, and with its distribution to the masses, and there's nothing wrong with it. You know, this is very good. And even today, if goodwill could be more generally stimulated in the hearts and minds of men, still good today. If it is the will to good which influences and directs you, then the awakening of mass aspiration, then to the awakening of mass aspiration, you know, which is still a responsibility, you must add the task of evoking the response to world need in the thinkers and aspirants through the medium of the second stanza, blending the two approaches in the effort to evoke via the hierarchy the will to save of Shambhala. So interesting to think of the will to save as connected with Shambhala. Normally we think of the Christ and the hierarchy as the saviors, but the greatest of all the saviors is Sanat Kumara, and this we must remember. Is Sanat Kumara. Where is our work? And now, of course, the third stanza had been given out, then 5 years later. They were given out at wide intervals, but of course the war had to be won before the third stanza could be given out, and even then would it have been given out if the Christ himself had not decided to reappear in bodily form. That was a great intended sacrifice, and it's in process now. And in response to that sacrifice, the evocation was the giving out of the third and greatest stanza, the invocation for power and light, probably stored in Shambhala for ages. When we think of the steps that have been taken to protect humanity and the planet, they are astonishing. And one day we will find ourselves in such a position, perhaps, where we are the protectors and the sustainers of the guardian wall. Perhaps the animal kingdom at present will not fall into such evil ways as has the humanity at present. Perhaps when the animal kingdom individualizes more thoroughly in the fifth round, there will be more of manas to direct the way and less of desire. We will see. Every period holds its own problems for solution. And as the old saying goes, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. So we handle what we have to handle now. And we cannot worry about, for instance, what we will have to handle at the judgment day, where I'm sure that some of us will be participating in one mode or another. We are into chapter 7 now. I wish we had a table of contents in the beginning of this. I'd have to kind of go through the book in order to determine the chapters, but we have been passing rapidly through chapters in the second part of the book, beginning on page 404 or 407. And now we come to a larger consideration, which relates to systemic and cosmic matters. We had tabulation 10, and maybe we should look at tabulation 10. I think on page 590 we will get what we need. We're not there yet. Yeah, here it is. And much too big, of course. So let us see how we can do this. Maybe I have that in a form that's already made, which would be good. So this is as per tabulation 10. And let us see, if we look up tabulation 10, what it gives us. I guess it gives us, all right. As per tabulation 10, and this is tabulation 10 here, this is a more complete, I think it's been given before. Let us see. Okay, I did a little homework here and straightened this out. And now here we do have tabulation 10. Let's see if we can get these where they belong. And there's the list, of course, of the constellations, their ray, and the planets which are orthodox and esoteric. The hierarchical ruler is not included here. One can wonder why, but even if the esoteric ruler is connected with the fixed cross, and if the fixed cross persists in its power, even as the cardinal cross is becoming stronger after the fourth initiation, we can see why the esoteric ruler is so important. But also, I would think the hierarchical ruler will begin to be effective to a certain degree, even after the third initiation. And then I suppose very effective for the master who thinks in terms of syntheses and wholes. The whole work in thinking about the crosses has been to think in terms of the simultaneous synthesis of a number of energies. So we come now to our last discussion upon the zodiac and its relation to the seven rays. I mean, in terms of tabulation 10, I've gone through it extensively in various places. Perhaps it will have to be dug up a bit, but I don't think there's much more that I can say about it per se, and we are coming to it again in another presentation on page 590. We have been occupied with the signs and their effects, and with the new and deeply esoteric astrology. We can tell how deep it really is by this last section, can't we? By the sections that began on page 404, 407. Which will gradually supersede the present mundane astrology. By the end of the century, it will have won its rightful place in human thought. Well, perhaps from their perspective, it has. At least I know among quite a number of esoteric astrologers who are working in this way, it has established its value. Maybe even in more conventional astrology astrological conventions, there is always given a little place for the presentation of esoteric astrology, probably viewed with a good deal of skepticism by those who have spent their whole life working in the exoteric astrology. I feel very grateful. You know, I still see myself reaching for that old book in the Gnostica bookstore back in I think it was 19... It was in the early 1970s, late 1960s. I remember, you know, it, as I said, it had pencil marks all over the person. Really hadn't gone beyond page 50. Just meandering pencil marks, and maybe I should have bought a new one, but I bought that and used it until it fell apart. I'm so grateful that, you know, I'd been a student of astrology already for, well, maybe avid student of astrology for maybe only 4 years, from 1965. And then a few years later, I ran at esoteric astrology. I still kept reading the normal astrology. I think it was hard to do something with esoteric astrology unless your entire thought form has to change. And how many people will have the patience to go through a process in which their astrological view of the world will undergo a radical shift? But I kept the book and forced myself to read it by teaching the subject, which is often a way to go. And gradually, it began to supplant the older thought forms. But it was not easy, and I still wanted to retain much of what the older thought forms meant until I found that those older thought forms, the ones that were of value, were contained within the esoteric astrological thought form. And that's where I stand today, you know. What, devoted to this book, or to the knowledge behind it, or to the master behind the knowledge, and so it goes, feeling that there's really something here for humanity, and we have to think it into the consciousness of human beings, even if we just let them know their ascendant sun and moon and what it can mean for the future, present, and past. That's something. One thing you must constantly bear in mind now that the war is over. Aha. When was all this written? When was it written? Or was it over on the inner side? Because we've seen that some of the sections were written, let's just say, after 1940. Some obviously had to be written before 1940. Some before 1942. And this one, now that the war is over. But what does that mean? Does that mean over on the inner side, or physically and technically over? And that time of acute trial and tribulation has come to an end. Okay. A great spiritual awakening of equality in nature, unpredictable today, will arrive. The war will have taught humanity many lessons and have torn the veil of self away from many eyes. In other words, this is the damaging, you might say, the tearing away of the blinding ahamkara principle, that principle of limited I-ness. Is all form of I-ness limited? Maybe not. Maybe there's a non-specific I-ness, which is the same as being, which is not limited. Values which have been hitherto expressed and understood only by those whose eyes are on God will be the goal and the desire of untold thousands. And indeed, we did see this great conscious awakening. True, or awakening of consciousness, true understanding between men and between nations will be a longed-for objective. What humanity determines to have, it ever succeeds in achieving. And this will go as well for the individual over incarnations. It is an encouraging thought. What humanity, what the individual determines to have, it ever succeeds in achieving. This is an occult law, for desire is as yet the strongest force in the world on our still astrally polarized planetary, within our still astrally polarized planetary logos and his planetary scheme, and within our still astrally polarized solar logos. This is an occult law, for desire is as yet the strongest force in the world. Organized, unfulfilled desire. Organized, unified desire was the basic reason for the appalling early successes of the Axis. Organized, unified desire. And, you know, Aries again, Germany, ruled by Aries, and Aries being a sign of early success, can it sustain what it begins? That's the thing. Aries is a sign of, let's call it, early success, but it evokes from its aggressions often the repercussions from those signs which are ruled by Libra, the other hemisphere of the chart, the western hemisphere of the chart. And there is the backlash, which frequently equilibrizes the whole situation and neutralizes the early gains. And thus it was the early gains of Germany and its allies were neutralized by the response of Britain, the United States, Russia, and so forth. Those nations particularly undertook the resistance against the Axis powers. They never were conquered. France resisted, of course, and there were resistance movements in Denmark and other places of which I'm aware, but they were conquered. They were subdued. Russia, England, and or the United Kingdom and America never were, and they resisted early on. Perhaps not fast enough. England did, but England by itself, or UK by itself, was not strong enough. It needed the closing in of Russia from the east and the United States from the west, and then the three could be effective in stopping the Aryan aggression. Aries is sometimes a sign of aggression. The only factor which can successfully oppose desire is will. Well, there we go. A great statement, an important statement, and one which could be underlined better than I did. Using the word in its spiritual connotation, a higher type of will, and as an expression of the first great divine aspect, not simply as the limited individual will, there was little of that organized spiritual will shown by the Allies. Little at first. He's looking retrospectively, maybe, in fact, at this writing, the war had ended. I think he did write in segments, and these segments might have been separated from each other at wide intervals. I know there was a time when, for 2 years, he wrote no letters to his group. So serious was the condition in the world. So he began by writing every 6 months, and by the time we were in the middle 1940s, there was a place where a two-year period elapsed with no writings. I'm sure the masters were greatly preoccupied, and one can only wonder how. One day we will know. So there was little of that organized spiritual will shown by the Allies. They were animated naturally by the desire for victory, desire for the arrival of the end of this all-engulfing world cataclysm, by desire for peace and a return to stability, the desire to end the war once and for all and to break its constantly recurring cycle, and a steadily mounting desire to bring to a finish the terrible toll of suffering, of cruelty, of death, of starvation, a fear which is gripping humanity by the throat in the attempt to strangle out its life. Powerful words, and we see the desire of the Allies. Yes, but not enough, right? Not enough. So this is where he starts to go into a discussion of the nature of the will. Because will would be required, and will works from the center outwards. Desire is often a magnetic reaching for something in the outer world and drawing it to oneself. A will is something that will not deflect its vision from anything but the inevitable victory. Will is undeflectable, and it is undeviating and invincible because it comes from the very source of power within one's own nature. It comes from that which is immortal, from that which is true being and will survive all reconfigurations of circumstance. So the fire of desire has to be fought with the fire of the will, especially of the will to good. It is the will to good which had to oppose the selfish desire. Will to good, opposing the selfish desire of the Axis powers. The looming religious war, of which DK speaks at a time when probably no one could conceive what its outlines would be, will also call for will on the part of those who seek to preserve human freedom against religious medievalism. And we still have that battle ahead of us. The nature of the will. But all this determination is, in most cases, simply the expression of a fixed and united desire. So, determination is an aspect of will which is closer to desire than is true and pure will of a spiritual nature. It is not the organized use of will. The principle of organization has to enter, the seventh ray has to enter, both ray one and ray seven, and really the whole hardline ray. The secret of the will lies in the recognition of the divine nature of man. When we know we are divine, when we know we are being, when we know that being will always prevail and cannot be touched, untouched, unmoved, unafraid. You know, you turn to page 285 of Discipleship in the New Age, and you see that pure being is unknown, unafraid, untouched, for A, unchanged, utterly reliable, utterly invincible, untouched, immutably the same. God is, and that which we are forever is. When one can realize that and rely upon that, so the secret of the will is the assertion of the immortal nature of being. When that is realized, then one becomes invincible because one is identified with that which is invincible. The form is never invincible, but that which has become the form, some say created but more become the form, is invincible. Only this can evoke the true expression of will. So we have to realize our immortality. Our immortality, the immortality of our divine essence. When this is realized, and it rarely is realized at first, we can begin to evoke the true expression of the will. It has, in fact, to be evoked by the soul as it dominates the human mind and controls the personality. So when one realizes oneself as an immortal unit of consciousness, one can evoke. And as a soul-identified being, control, dominate the human mind and control the personality. As a soul-identified, IDFD, being. That's what we have to realize ourselves as. And then the major victories of Aries are possible, because Aries will overcome all things through its identification with being, but not through lower forms of formal aggression. The secret of the will is also closely tied in with the recognition of the unconquerable nature of goodness and the inevitability of the triumph of the good. One has to have deep faith first, and then realization. The good is that which arises from the perception of God. It is the archetype which is set forth by the creative power of God, whatever God it may be. And this archetype will prevail over all lesser configurations. We have so many relationships in the lower world which are not in alignment with this archetypal creation of God. But the archetype outlasts the lower creations. Thus do I know that God will victor be, and later hold my mind and me in thrall. So, a deep faith in the outcome, based upon a sense of purpose, abiding archetypal purpose, will be strong enough to overcome the temporary aggressions of lower forms animated by desire. So this is not determination. It is not whipping up and stimulating desire so it can be transmuted into will, which it can. Okay. It is not an implacable, unshakable, immovable focusing of all energies in the need to triumph. The enemies of the forces of light are adept at that, and so is the Black Lodge. So let's look here. What will is not? This is not determination. This is a popular saying, a popular quotation in the esoteric teaching. It is not determination. It is not the whipping up and stimulating desire. He does say, you know, whip yourself into shape and whip the form into shape. He does use the whip. DK does use the whip, and it is important in transmuting desire into will, but not this. It is not an implacable, unshakable, immovable focusing of all energies in the need to triumph, because where is the level of identification? You know, that's the point. The true will necessitates a deeper level of identification with being, with life, with reality, with essence, with substance, all of these equivalent terms in a way, even the last one, although maybe it should be capitalized. Victory for the Allies did lie in the effort to produce this focusing with better effect than the enemy, this focusing, using the power of organization as will. So the first and seventh rays together. The secret of will lies in the recognition of the divine nature. Desire is not the organized use of the will. Organization comes into this. Recognition of divinity within and an immortal, invincible divinity. And an invincible creation of an archetype, a sustained purpose, which arises from true being and from that which is internally persistent. So goodness arises from the nature of being and the inevitability of this, of the triumph of this sustained archetype created by the mind of God, a congeries of higher energies which will be determining upon all those lesser configurations in the mosaic world, as I call it, you know, the world of parts and pieces here below. So what the Nazis and such were missing was a higher identification. These evil forces were lacking a higher identification with being, with reality. Victory for the Allies did lie in the effort to produce this focusing of all energies to better effect and from a state of identification with the good. State of identification with the good. The use of the will is not expressed by an iron fixation. Okay, you know, look, he's giving us a hint. This is not expressed by Mars. Mars is not strong enough. Mars has a lower state of identification connected with the consciousnesses that it influences. Iron breaks. It's a lower, it's not steel. It is not the higher will. There is a strong will, which is influenced by Mars. But the use of will is not expressed by an iron fixation to stand steady and not yield. I suppose that's part of it to a degree, because the rising up of courage on the battlefield of life is much promoted by Mars. Yet, determination, the focusing of energy, and the demonstration of an all-out effort towards victory were only, where the Allies were concerned, the expression of a one-pointed desire for peace and for an ending of the trouble. Trouble. There was determination. There was the effort to stand steady, but this was still not enough. But the love of peace, a one-pointed desire for peace and for the ending of the trouble, the type of effort is something which the masses can give, and which they did give on both sides of the conflict. But desire is not enough. I mean, you know, this is basically what he's always telling us. In the overcoming of desire, selfish desire, the desire for the good is not enough. Something else was being added. There is, however, a plus, a something else which swung the tide of victory onto the side of the Allies. I guess some people say, well, you know, you're an old man here, you're still fighting an old war, you're 70 years old, you're fighting an old war. But this war was determining for the fate of humanity. This war is not over, in my view. And if this war had not been won, we would not be talking and thinking about the things we are now talking and thinking about. The forces of darkness would have overcome, the teaching would have been eradicated, the books would have been destroyed. Maybe somewhere a few would have survived, who knows, but all our resources would have been destroyed. We would not be able, the way has been cleared for us by the heroism, by the bravery of many who were making sacrifices for things in the future that they could not even understand, for a divine plan which was far from their ability to apprehend. The way has been cleared for us so we can study these things and learn about these things and influence the consciousness of humanity by these things, by the great teaching. So we owe, you know, debt of gratitude to so many people we have never met who sacrificed their lives. And for the blood, sweat, and tears of the masters who, at great sacrifice to themselves, have given us this teaching. And we're told of the return of the Buddha at great cost to himself every year. Of these things we have no idea except to know that we are sustained by great sacrifices. Every time you make a sacrifice, or I make a sacrifice, we are sustaining someone we may not even know. We are strengthening them. As Master Moria said, and I often repeat, just so I get it myself, when have you ever become less through sacrifice? But there is a plus, a something else, which swung the tide of victory onto the side of the Allies. It came through an unrealized effort to understand and express the quality of spiritual will. It was the manifestation of that divine energy which made the first divine aspect of will or power what it is. Spiritual will, coming from the atmic plane, coming from the sacrifice petals of the egoic lotus in an attenuated form, but beginning, at least as far as we're concerned, on the atmic plane. The will to good of the atmic plane.